You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Each year, Project Censored publishes a collection of news stories that have not received much attention from most media outlets. And on today's Underreported, we look at some of the important stories from the past year that they feel you should have heard about. Joining me now is Mickey Huff, Associate Director of Project Censored and co-editor of Censored 2010, the top 25 censored stories of 2008-2009. It's published by Seven Stories Press. I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Huff to today's Underreported segment. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for having us on.
So how do you define censored? Does censorship have to be deliberate?
Actually, censorship is a really complicated issue, and we actually have the specific definitions that we use at Project Censored on our website at projectcensored.org. And what we call modern media censorship is actually anything that interferes with the free flow of information in our democratic society. So censorship is often seen as sort of this top-down hand that just sort of prevents a story from being produced at all. But the most, which does happen sometimes, but that's obviously difficult to detect. The most common forms of censorship involve skewing of information, slighting of content, framing, not telling people the full story or all of the facts or historical context that really lend important meaning and interpretation to a story. So that tends to skew the way things can be reported and interpreted, and that also is a form of censorship. Any form of propaganda relies on censorship.
Isn't a role of the media to act as gatekeepers by filtering out the extraneous noise? For example, I get a lot of requests to book guests who claim that Barack Obama is a socialist or that he's Hitler, that he's controlled by George Soros. Others want me to put on guests who say that Dick Cheney is an emissary of the devil. Am I engaging in censorship when I just delete those requests?
Well, that's a really good point that you're making, and I think that there is a potentially fine line between news judgment, you know, ombudsman-type work, editorial-type work of seeing, well, is there factual merit to what's being said? And I think what we're really looking at Project Censored is fact-based reporting, transparent sourcing. So we don't judge a story by the mainstreaming or popularity of its potential interpretation. We really look at it, and it goes through a series of vetting processes by professors, experts, students, and research databases that show that, you know, the stories that we put in Project Censored every year are fact-based. They are stories that are relevant to what's going on in our society, and therefore they ought to be discussed, and the truth should be ferreted out. After all, the First Amendment's free press protection is supposed to embolden journalists to seek the truth regardless of its popularity.
Well, in the past year, the news industry has been hit hard by the recession, with magazines and newspapers closing. Does that mean that more stories are being underreported or ignored, or has the Internet been able to fill that void?
Well, I think that that's an interesting question, and the answer is yes and no in different ways. The cover of our 2010 book this year is a series of empty newspaper dispensing machines, which implies the first part of your question on one hand, but it also implies that another reason that newspapers maybe are getting hit hard and corporate news outlets have been, I mean, the news industry in general has been deregulated and conglomerized over the last couple of decades, which means fewer jobs, fewer journalists, fewer people to report these things. But it also is symbolic of the fact that corporate media is really not in the news business. They're in the infotainment and entertainment business and propaganda business for advertising. So that's really another major problem. And while there certainly are great journalists and reporters that work for major media outlets, they really do have their hands tied because of a number of restrictions, including simply the one you mentioned, resources, the lack of resources, actually, in a recession. But they also have different types of marching orders, given that they are owned by major corporations, they are beholden to advertiser dollars, they rely on elite sources rather than actually going into the trenches and getting, you know, other alternative information. There seems to be a lack of significant fact-checking in a lot of these outlets. So what we're doing, what we're saying at Project Censored is corporate media has largely made itself irrelevant over the years, and the Internet is stepping in, of course, but as you well know about the Internet, it's a needle in a haystack kind of game. It's like telling somebody to go to the library to find some information. I mean, you don't know where to go or where to start.
Well, though, there are places like ProPublica and Spotus, which are nonprofits that support and publish the work of investigative journalists. I guess they see themselves as filling in that vacuum.
That's right, and actually Project Censored does the same. We actually also have a blog, thedailycensored.com, and Media Freedom Foundation, which is the nonprofit that controls Profit Censored, on which I sit on the board with Peter Phillips and others. We have a new website called Media Freedom International that publishes investigative research and these types of investigative reports. So there are many outlets, but, you know, I teach media literacy and history, and a lot of the students, you know, the first thing they ask is, well, where do you get information? So even though we're awash in a sea of information, there seems to be a paucity of understanding and how to connect the dots and make sense of what's real and what's not.
Well, we will put a link to your website on our website so people can see what you have to offer. There are a lot of economic stories in this year's edition of Censored 2010, but wasn't the economy covered as one of the year's biggest stories?
Yeah, you're right, it was, which highlights our definition of censorship quite well. In fact, in the top 25 stories this year, stories number 1, 6, 8, 14, and 19 all relate to economics and these types of issues. But it's not so much that, oh, these stories were covered. It's what wasn't covered or what specifically is really left out of the most widely disseminated stories that come through corporate media about the fiscal debacle. And actually, again, projectcensored.org, your listeners can go to the right side of our website and read the top 25 censored stories from 2010 for free, and they can look at all the archive dating back to 1976 when the project was founded by Carl Jensen at Sonoma State University.
So tell us about your number one censored story.
Well, the number one censored story this year, as you illustrated, is economics. It's how the U.S. Congress has basically sold out to Wall Street. And the stories are actually quite interconnected about lobbying lobbyists buying Congress, bailed out banks and America's wealthiest cheat the IRS out of billions of dollars. How Congress has invested in defense contracts, bank bailouts, we're using taxpayer money to defeat labor interests. So these are all interrelated stories. The first one, of course, the biggest, is again one that highlights the definition of censorship. It's certainly the case that this story about the bailouts and, you know, the Wall Street problems were definitely covered. What wasn't widely discussed, of course, is that 8 of the most troubled firms donated $64 million to congressional candidates. And the donors included Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, AIG, and Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac. So that, again, leads to these questions of, well, these are some of the biggest donors to people that are sitting on these committees, the Security and Exchange Committees and House Financial Services Committees. And then these groups then turn around and they basically bail out these groups. And I think that if you really look at that story number one in conjunction with story number six, this is a staggering figure that $32,000 per legislator per day is what lobbyists are spending in Washington, D.C. You know, the federal government's handing out billions of dollars by the day. And this then, in turn, is money that goes back to pay for lobbyists that go and influence people that are on these significant committees.
So there's
that's a really major story.
So there's a big boom in the lobbying industry. But hasn't the New York Times done a number of stories about that? Are people in large media centers like New York, Washington, and L.A. more likely to learn about some of these things than people in other parts of the country?
I think it's possible, but the lobbyist story was covered by the Center for Responsive Politics. You know, we LexisNexis all these stories to see where they're covered and where they're published. And the only way they get into the top 25 is if they're completely overlooked or thoroughly distorted by the corporate media. Story number one, for example, you know, there was a story by Matt Taibbi, you know, in the Rolling Stone. The other ones are a website called Truth Out and another publication called Capital I. Those are hardly household names. Rolling Stone, of course, is, but most people don't read Rolling Stone to read the news.
Yeah, we did have Matt Taibbi on our show to talk about that. One of the things that you mentioned here is that the finance, insurance, and real estate sector spent $453.4 $5 million in lobbying in 2008, but TARP fund recipients are spending less this year so far. Because they don't have to anymore? They've already gotten the money?
Well, I'm not sure if it's necessarily that they don't have to. They certainly already do have the money on the one hand. And, I mean, just before this, your program started, you know, the NPR news was talking about Goldman Sachs quadrupling in profits. I mean, these groups clearly are getting a return on their money. And when they're in dire straits, you might be able to see that they're paying more money. When things are going well, they're still paying money. They're still piling money into Washington. But, you know, I think it's also interesting that on the run-up here, this is another example of framing and another example of, you know, using NPR as an example. Yeah, you're reporting about, you know, Goldman Sachs quadrupling profits, Citigroup is down. But also a report was how unemployment was down. But there was no mention on the NPR news here about how foreclosures are actually up. So again, it's a matter of choice. It's a matter of somebody's reporting certain stories and not reporting certain others. And if you want to take another look at this, and you want to look and see, you know, even at NPR, which is often a much better, much better source of covering fact-based information, even in that regard, what's chosen to lead at the headlines is remarkably different than what you're going to see at, say, Democracy Now, you know, where they did run a whole story this morning on foreclosures hitting an all-time high and tying it in to record bonuses and employee bonuses that reach $140 billion. That's the kind of news and information that we think at Project Censored people really need to hear about to connect the dots, not just horse race polls and statistics, particularly statistics that say unemployment is down. Well, that gives people the mistaken impression that things are going well, where the foreclosure report clearly indicates otherwise.
Mickey, to defend NPR, foreclosures have been a major story on NPR News for a while. We're talking about a three-minute news broadcast where you're trying to condense all the headlines. Democracy Now! Is a show that goes on and on and on into infinity. So, you know, we're talking about to the point where, forgive me, where I fall asleep. But that's a whole other matter.
That's hyperbolic on both counts. I'll take blame for the hyperbole, and certainly you were just exaggerating Democracy Now! As well. But I was just using that as an example of choices and news choices. Again, you're entirely correct. And as I stated, NPR does a much better job of covering a lot of these important stories. And obviously, your program, I mean, here we are talking about, you know, these types of things. But, you know, I don't know if you're too familiar with this, Lenny, but there aren't a lot of shows like this on.
That's a point we try to make more than once while we're fundraising. People may be surprised to learn that public schools are more segregated today than they were in the 1950s. Is that a result of funding?
Well, I think it's a result of many things, you know, frankly. One of the things it's a result of is that I think that a lot of us in America have kind of turned our backs on some of these problems that because we mistakenly believe that they were solved in previous generations. Like the whole civil rights era and movements of the 1950s and 1960s going into the war on poverty through the early some of the policies ending in the early 1970s, where we really did address a lot of these issues and we really did try to seriously rectify inequality in our society. But if you look at all the other indicators dating from the 70s up to the present, Gary Orfield did this study, the Civil Rights Project at UCLA, called Reviving the Goal of an Integrated Society, a 21st Century Challenge. And what Orfield found, and this was not covered in the corporate media, what Orfield found was that schools are more segregated today than they were 40 years ago, and essentially that non-white students are part of dropout factory high schools where they have less and less opportunity and they're less and less prepared to go to college, which then would lead to them being potentially less prepared to function as remote equals in the U.S. economy. And I think that's certainly something that we should be looking at and we should be talking about in our society and education policy. And instead of like the last 8 years, when we look at the outcome of education through testing and No Child Left Behind, we really ought to be looking at who's actually going through these programs and what are the real problems for teachers, educators, students, parents, boards of education. What are the real problems for people going on in everyday America? You know, and I think the UCLA study really points that out. And it's ironically, given the stereotypes that people have about the West and California being liberal and progressive and so on, the problems of segregation are actually worse in California than in the South and many other places where, you know, people may be very surprised to learn that as well.
I was earlier bragging about New York as a place where you can learn the news, but I've I have to report that the headlines of today's of the tabloids in New York today, in the Daily News, it was "I deserve to die," a woman who was responsible for the death of a kid because she was driving drunk, and the New York Post is "After 18 years of captivity, JC is smiling again." Neither of those are economic stories, that's for sure, or stories about Afghanistan or anything else. But we will come back and cover some of the other 25 stories that have gone underreported with Mickey Huff, who, with Peter Phillips and Project Censored, put together Censored 2010, the top 25 censored stories of 2008-2009. It's published by Seven Stories Press. Stay with us for more. We're back with Mickey Huff, co-editor with Peter Phillips and Project Censored, of this year's edition of the Censored series, Censored 2010, the top 25 censored stories of 2008-2009, which is published by Seven Stories Press. We have talked about stories about the economy and schools. There's a lot of other stuff. But you also co-wrote a chapter. Well, you wrote about the whole matter of whether – what is the title here? "Analysis of Project Censored. Are we a left-leaning, conspiracy-oriented organization?" Is that a charge that's been leveled against the project often?
I don't know. Often, but it certainly is something that some critics have claimed, that because we look at people in power and believe that the role of the free press is to hold people in power in a democratic society accountable for their decisions and actions, and how policy should be sort of hashed out in public, people say that, well, we have this left-leaning bias, or because we ask questions about very controversial issues, such as election fraud or problems with the 9/11 Commission reports, inaccuracies or potential omissions. So people, there's a lot of trepidation, certainly among the institutionalized press and elite press, to sort of really tread on some of those issues. So we have been accused of those things. So Peter and I decided to go back and look at a history of Project Censored stories over the last two presidential administrations. Just to show that we're not a partisan organization in terms of Republican and Democrat. Our bias is for a free press to, again, hold people in power accountable and try to seek the fact-based truth and get it out to the public so they can make informed decisions.
Did you find that you were as tough on the Clinton administration as you were on the Bush administration?
Absolutely. And we're already looking at the Obama administration.
Well, in fact, the first story we talked about, that financial firms are giving a lot of money to Congress. We're talking about a Congress which Democrats control right now. And there's also a story here about President Obama's military appointees. Is it unusual that some of his high-profile appointees were once lobbyists and board members of companies that do business with the Pentagon, especially when you consider that President Obama promised to keep former lobbyists out of top government posts?
I think that you just hit it on the head with the last thing that you said. 2 days after Obama signed his ethics pledge, he took the opportunity to appoint William Lynn to the number two spot at the Pentagon, and Lynn came from Raytheon. He was a senior vice president for government operations and strategy at Raytheon, so that was a real big blow. Not to mention the fact that Robert Gates is the first he's the first appointment from an outgoing administration of an opposing party that was kept in the same position. So that's also something that's unprecedented. And if you look at a history of Gates, I mean, there's a whole host of issues and things that should have come up to be discussed. Certainly people that were voting for change, from the 2006 elections forward, one of the things that was becoming clearer in the electorate is the questioning of the war efforts, questioning of war policy in Iraq and Afghanistan. The numbers had tilted against those operations and those wars. And the maintaining of Gates really doesn't represent change. And the appointing of William Lynn from Raytheon is just a slap in the face to Obama's own ethics pledge. So those are things that are very questionable.
There are other stories that you specifically want mentioned before we go on to some of the honorable mentions and your discussion of infotainment?
Actually, the third story, we were talking about talking about race in the second story, and another one of the themes other than the economy is race, of course, in the stories, and that also carries through the infotainment, the junk food news and news abuse chapter. But story number three, since we did the first two, the third story is on toxic waste behind the Somali pirates. And the Somali pirates story is, of course, something that has been widely covered in the corporate media. In fact, even on your program, not long ago, a little over a month ago, you had a report on from Jonathan Ledgard from the Economist.
Mm-hmm. About private contractors protecting container ships.
Right. So this was on your show underreported, and it's interesting that there's a number of facets of this story that are underreported, including the private security firms. The angle that we were looking at in terms of the Somali pirates in story number three was the illegal, unreported, and unregulated fleets that have been poaching and dumping toxic waste off Somalia since it became a failed state after Mogadishu in the early 1990s.
Mickey, can I pat myself on the back on this one? We covered that story 2 years ago on Underreported.
Wonderful. You covered the story about the poaching.
Yes, and the toxic dumping.
Right. Well, you should certainly pat yourself on the back for that one. I thought it was interesting that in the Economist story, they had mentioned the pirates' ransom of $2.5 million, but there was no mention of the $450 million in seafood that was taken from Somali water. So kudos to you and hats off to you for doing that story. But it was widely overlooked in the corporate media, of which NPR is technically not.
There, you also include descriptions of the stories that received honorable mentions. What separates them from the winning stories?
Well, it's interesting to say whether they're winning stories or losing because of some of the bleak nature of the topics. We have a process that we go through, and of course, vetting is a major process. Accuracy, where the stories are reported, whether they're not reported or underreported, and they go through a series of votes by both members of classes that work with Project Censored, and we have over 30 college and university affiliates helping us do research now. But they also go to a panel of national judges where they're then voted upon. And one of the critiques, of course, has been, well, gee, there's so many stories. I mean, we get over 160, 170 stories every year easily, and people can nominate stories at projectcensored.org. But it's really difficult to go through and then pick some of these quote-unquote better stories or what makes the top 25. So we really try to include as many as we can and in the runner-ups. And now on the web, we're doing this validated independent news cycle where all the stories that we're looking at all year round are posted at mediafreedominternational.org. So we're really trying to expand the project and really trying to create a repository of transparent and independent fact-based information for people in our society to go and look at.
You co-wrote the chapter about infotainment. Which stories, different stories that made it to your top 10 list of what you call junk food news stories? I imagine next year you will include the one that I saw just last night when CNN interrupted a conversation about the war in Afghanistan to announce that Rush Limbaugh has dropped out of the group that's bidding to become the owners of the St. Louis Rams.
Absolutely. That's certainly going to be in the running. Tyra Banks, shifting figure, the death of Michael Jackson, Obama's beer summit. There's a sort of a differentiation between junk food and news abuse. Junk food is kind of like Twinkies for the brain, like you mentioned, stuff that's really irrelevant and doesn't technically matter. The news abuse category is they're stories that, well, there is some importance to them. They are significant, but then the way that they end up getting covered in the corporate media are just really trivializing. And so every year for the last 25 years, we've looked at these stories, and they've been nominated, and we sort of vote on them. And what we do is because one of the critiques of Project Censored, again, has been, well, you know, news agencies can't do everything. They have concision. They only have so much time and so many column inches, so they can't possibly do everything. So Carl Jensen, the founder, and then Peter Phillips thereafter began looking at, well, what do they cover? And we discovered, of course, like you said, they'll often interrupt or preempt other actual news stories to talk about the titillating, the spectacle, the absurd, scandals, gossip, anecdotes, etc. For example, in 2007, when CNN cut to nearly 2 hours of uninterrupted coverage of Anna Nicole Smith's death, that was the longest uninterrupted so-called news break on CNN since the events of September the 11th. I mean, that just also highlights the absurdity of our infotainment culture.
Well, why do you think we're seeing these infotainment stories migrate from the gossip magazines to more news-based media outlets?
Well, one reason, of course, is ratings and advertiser money, and you know, these things are often titillating, and they're things that people can sort of glom onto because America is largely a culture of spectacle and illusion. You know, as New York University the late New York University professor Neil Postman wrote about 25 years ago in "Amusing Ourselves to Death." You know, these are things that, of course, sell and they gather attention to people, but they also clearly distract away and take away from serious news coverage. And I think this is another reason why the corporate news media are making themselves increasingly irrelevant, is because of what you just said. They'll interrupt a very important discussion on something that's very crucial and an issue in our humankind and human societies for something that, you know, really doesn't matter to anybody but a handful of people.
Now, voting problems and irregularities became national headlines after the 2000 election and in Ohio after the 2004 election. Did we see the same kinds of voting problems during last year's presidential election?
Actually, we saw some problems persist, and there's actually a whole chapter in Project Censored this year. It's chapter 11 in this year's book that was written by the blogger Brad Friedman, who occasionally sits in for Mike Malloy on Air America. And it's Election 2008, Vanishing Votes, Disappearing Democracy, and Media Misdirection. And the Brad blog is a place where you can see a whole lot of really cutting-edge reporting on election fraud. And sadly, the frauds have in our electoral process have continued. The failures of electronic machines have continued. And this even made infotainment news on Oprah Winfrey, if you might recall. So this is something that just doesn't seem to get a really serious attention. I mean, to such that people like Brad or Bev Harris at Black Box Voting tend to give it, or Steve Freeman, you know, a statistical researcher at the University of Pennsylvania. So we think this is a really important story for a democratic society, and we think some of the coverage of it has really just been skewed and marginalized.
Why didn't the campaigns that had the most to gain or the parties raise it as an issue?
I think it's a dual-edged sword, you know, because if you go back historically, you can see this problem on both of the major party sides. But I think the most significant coverage as of late is really based on the technology and the potential for manipulation of voting technology. And I don't think it matters if you're a Democrat, if you're a Republican, or what party you're in, or a party, any party at all. I mean, if you're really serious about democratic participation, then you really have to be serious about the, you know, transparent verification of voting and the security of your vote so that your vote is counted. And, you know, this has been a problem dating all the way back to the beginning of our country, so it's not like it's new. But I do think that it's something that sort of gets short shrifted, and it often turns in either one party or another turns it into a sour grapes argument. And again, I think that also distracts away from the importance of it. And I think when people vote, they should have the security to know that their vote has been counted. After all, these voting machine companies are the same companies that run ATMs and your banking machines. You don't go to your bank and deposit a check and not get a receipt just to make sure your money is in there. But yet they claim they can't provide these kinds of things. And that's obviously nonsense. So I think it's something that we really ought to be paying much more close attention to.
A lot of media critics have examined the coverage of the run-up to the invasion of Iraq and the reporting from the early days of the war. Have the major media outlets improved their reporting on the wars of in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Pentagon more recently?
Oh, sadly, I'd have to say overall the answer to that question is no. A colleague of mine at Diablo Valley College just published a book on that entire subject, and there's an article at Media Freedom International about it called Preparing for the Next Deception. The book is called The Anatomy of Deception, and it actually goes up and looks at all the major problems and fallacies leading up to the Iraq War, and I think we really ought to revisit that. I know the mantra these days has been we need to look forward, not backward, but if we don't see the context from which we've come, then we have a hard time dissecting issues in the present. And, you know, the Pentagon just recently said that we can't show the, you know, more pictures and we can't be reporting. There was a big flap because the AP recently reported, showed photographs of a dying U.S. soldier, and it created a lot of controversy. And I understand that that's a very difficult issue, and it's a very sensitive issue. But it's also an issue that's the truth of war. And I think if we would see more actual reporting of the human cost of war, as well as the financial cost, but more importantly, the human cost of war, I think we would really have a much more sober debate in our country about what we're doing in our foreign policy.
You also have a section where you follow up on some of the stories from the last 10 years, including last year's top story about the number of civilian deaths in Iraq. Do we have new numbers on civilian deaths?
I'm afraid we'd have very little reporting going on about that follow-up from number one. And, you know, not a little over a year ago when, you know, some of the major polling organizations asked Americans how many Iraqis they believed dead as a result of U.S. occupation. Sadly, the number was, the people believed the number to be fewer than 10,000. And I mean, even the most conservative reports, the most conservative figures that are unchallenged by the government are well in excess of 100,000. And if you look at the Lancet studies and the opinion research business studies, where they're using the same methodology as they used to count the dead in the Rwandan genocide, and those methodologies have not been significantly challenged, and those numbers are widely accepted, those same methods have been used in the counting of Iraq, and what we see is 1.2 million dead Iraqis and 4.5 million refugees, which is reported by Dar Jamal. And that's another story that has gotten some coverage in media, in corporate media, but the significance of it has not. There's people are led to believe that refugees are returning and so on, and things are improving. And the reality on the ground is actually quite different than that if you read unembedded independent journalists working in the region.
Mountaintop coal removal was discussed in the 2006 edition, but it did become an issue during the Democratic primary last year. So do some of these stories finally make a leap from being underreported to becoming major stories?
I'm really glad you brought that up, Lenny, just that whole process in general. And it shows, too, like yours, that help propagate these things and help keep these important stories alive so that there's this possibility that they'll get picked up eventually. And occasionally, that happens. I mean, again, sadly, what we're seeing with mountaintop removal and things right now is not necessarily going in the direction of protecting people that are living there and so forth. But, I mean, at least it's something that was on the radar, and we're hopeful that that's something that will stay on the radar as not just a regional issue, you know, but an issue in terms of our environmental policies and what we're doing as a country to really move forward rather than backward.
We've been talking about bad news that gets underreported. Does any good news get underreported?
I'm also very glad that you brought that up. In fact, oftentimes when people are getting the book, I tell them right away, I say, please go to chapter 4. That's the good news story, and that's compiled by Kate Sims of Project Censored and the people of Yes Magazine. And it is true. There are really good things that are going on around the world that are also not reported. So if you go and you look in Chapter 4 of the book this year, there's stories on healthy government, you know, the Iraqi organization promoting peaceful elections. There are stories about accountability, about the Hawaiian senator introducing whistleblower protections. For people, there's leads on regulation where Europe is regulating chemicals and American companies are really having to cut back on a lot of the toxic chemicals that they use if they want to maintain global trade. So I think these are all things that are going, you know, in a really positive direction for our health, public health, and really creating a more sustainable system of trade and economics.
The book we've been talking about is Censored 2010, the top 25 censored stories. It's edited by Peter Phillips and the Project Censored, and also Mickey Huff, who's been our guest. It has an introduction by Dar Jamal, and even has cartoons, and it's published by Seven Stories Press. Thank you so much for talking with us today on our underreported segment.
Thanks so much for having us, Lenny, and keep doing great work.